I titled today's lesson, What is the text telling us? What is the text telling us? Now, every teacher is looking for that, when they're studying, they're looking for that aha moment. And what I mean by that is, as you're studying, you're struggling through it, and you just kind of go, aha, got it. That's what it's trying to tell us. And I was really struggling trying to get my hand, you see all these texts that I've listed there in your notes. I was really struggling trying to get my arms all around these texts and what is it trying to tell us. And so I started going through it. And if you look in Luke chapter 8, and that's where we're really going to focus on. We'll mention the other one some, but Luke chapter 8, beginning in verse 22, do I just read through these? Do I read through them and say, okay, all right, Jesus calmed the sea? I mean, pretty much, if you've been in church at all, you know about Jesus calming the sea. And we can certainly draw an inference there to, if He can calm the sea, if He can stop a storm, He can stop the storm in your life. And we talk about that a little bit, right? Or if you keep reading on there, He cast the demons out of this guy. He cast demons out of the guy. The guy's living in the graveyard. And he cast them into the pigs. The pigs run off into the lake out there, jump off a cliff, and they do a swine dive, right? I knew some of y'all would catch that. I knew none of you. And I said, well, we could do that. And we could say, you know, this is really, let's focus on this. And we could talk about material possessions and how the people were more concerned about the material possessions than they were about God and what God was doing. And then when you get to the last story here, it's the story of him raising a girl from the dead. And you say, well, okay, well, we'll talk about faith and how with faith you can do pretty much anything. And I've heard sermons on all of those things, some even here in this church. Is that what we should be doing? Is that what this passage is really all about? Or should I just kind of come back and address it from the point of view of going, okay, here's the sea, and here's the boat, and here's the circumstances, and just kind of help you understand better what's going on there and what was happening? Or do I kind of show you the passage that deal with demon possession, and we talk about demon possession and who can be possessed and who can't be possessed and what do you do, and we kind of deal with that. And then when you look at Jesus' power here over death, certainly we could talk about how that could be a comfort for us in the time of death. What is the text telling us? That's really what I was struggling with. And I came up with 3 points. And from these 3 points, we're going to draw a conclusion. And so we'll just kind of walk through it, and I'll show the 3 points to you, and then we'll come to a conclusion from that. All right, and the first point is listed there in your notes. Jesus controls the natural world. Jesus controls the natural world. Here's what we've got. Jesus is in the area of the Sea of Galilee. He's been there. He's been there for some time now. He's been teaching. It's been a long, long day for him. And during this day, he's been teaching to these large, massive crowds. They're so large and they're so big that they've pushed him literally into the sea. He ends up having to get into a boat and teach them from the edge of the shore there. I mean, that's how large it is. He's teaching in parables, and he's teaching in parables, and he's teaching in parables, and then he has to go to his disciples and say, this is what the parables mean. It's been a long, long day. And so finally, he's there at the edge of the sea, and Jesus turns to the disciples and says, look, I'm tired. Well, let's go to the other side of the sea. Let's get away from these people. I need some rest. And so they get into a boat, and off they go across the Sea of Galilee. Now, we have to do a little geography lesson here concerning the Sea of Galilee so that you get a kind of a picture of what's going on here. It's a little bit larger than Grapevine Lake. I mean, when you hear the word sea, you immediately think that it's massive, right? It's a little bit bigger than than Grapevine Lake. Grapevine Lake is 10 miles long. Sea of Galilee is 13 miles, just a few miles long. The Sea of Galilee is some 6 miles wide at its widest point. Grapevine is 2 miles wide. So not a whole lot larger. But there is something that makes it very, very unique. And what I mean by that is, it's one of the most studied lakes in all the world because of where it's located. Grapevine Lake is about 500 feet above sea level. 500 feet above sea level. The Sea of Galilee is 600 feet below sea level. 1,100 feet difference. quite a distance there, right? In fact, it's the lowest freshwater lake in all the world. It is the lowest freshwater lake in all the world. The lowest saltwater lake in all the world is the Dead Sea, right? Right down the road. And so you've got the lowest freshwater lake in all the world. It's 1,100 feet lower than Lake Grapevine. But there's more to it than just that. It's not just 1,100 feet lower than Lake Grapevine. It's also surrounded on three sides by hills, plateaus, and mountains. And let me explain the way it works. On the west side, the west side would be this way, on the west side of the lake, it's 2,100 feet up to these rolling hills. 2,100 feet up from the lake are these hills. And so you've got that on the west side of the lake. On the east side of the lake is a plateau, and that plateau is known as the Golan Heights. It's 3,500 feet up to them. And so when those of you who remember the Golan Heights and all the things that were going, if you remember what the Palestinians were doing, were they were up on the Golan Heights and doing what? Raining down on them, right? Kind of easy to do, 3,500 feet below, and that's what they were doing. And so you've got the hills 2,100 feet above the lake on one side. You've got Golan Heights 3,500 feet. And then when you go to the north, you've got the mountains of Lebanon that are 10,000 feet. And so it's setting down in a bowl is what the picture is. And so here's why that's important. As you're setting down here in this bowl, all these hills and plateaus and mountains all around you, you've got warm air, you've got cold air, you've got warm surfaces, you've got cold surfaces, you've got water surfaces, you've got land surfaces. And what happens then is the wind begins to blow. And as the wind begins to blow, you have this natural topography that's all around it, and it begins to funnel that wind down towards the lake. And it's just like anything. If you take it and you begin to, it starts out very, very wide, and you begin to narrow it down, it does what? It gets stronger and stronger and stronger until it gets to a point. And that's what happens on I was about to say Lake Grapevine, that's what happens on the Sea of Galilee. The wind would just rise up out of nowhere, and come crashing down into the Sea of Galilee. So here's what you've got. You've got Jesus and His disciples. They get into a boat. If you go over to Mark's Gospel, I've always thought it was just Jesus and the disciples in a boat. But Mark's Gospel tells us there are other followers in other boats. There are other people following along in their little boats. And so here they're going. They're going out across the lake. And it's nightfall. And so this crowd follows them in these other boats, but the massive crowd can't get to them, and so he's going across the lake to get away from them. Now remember, these disciples are fishermen, and not just any fishermen, they're fishermen from where? This lake, right? This lake, they fished on it all their lives, literally. And so they're very, very familiar with this lake. And so they're going across the lake, and off they go. It's 5 miles across. It won't take us long at all. We'll get there before long. No motors on the boat, right? Just the wind blowing them across the lake. And so what the text tells us, as you look at it, it tells us that Jesus went in there and He laid down and went to sleep. He's exhausted. From a human standpoint, His human nature is just exhausted, and He went to sleep. And so Mark tells us that He takes a pillow. Someone gives Him a pillow, and He actually laid His head down on the pillow. And so here you have this picture. The Son of God, God in human flesh, is exhausted, and He lays down and goes to sleep. But what about His divine nature? We've said He's 100% man, but He's also 100% God. His divine nature is there, right? He goes to sleep even though He knows there's a storm coming. He goes to sleep, goes in there and lays down even though His divine nature knows that there's a storm coming. He knows everything. He knows the storm is coming. But He doesn't have to prepare. He doesn't have to get ready for this storm whatsoever. He doesn't have to make any necessary preparation whatsoever on His part have to be made. He can go to sleep, He can rest, and at the appropriate time, He will get up and take care of the storm. So you look at Jesus, and there's this beautiful picture here of just calm. I mean, he, even though He knows the storm is coming, He can lay His head down and go to sleep and just rest. And so in verse 23, it tells us, that all of a sudden the calm, the tranquility there is broken, and it's replaced by this deadly storm. And Luke calls it a fierce gale is the word that he uses. And that Greek word means hurricane or tornado or whirlwind. And so you get the picture of it, right? I mean, this is not just some little breeze that blew up all of a sudden. It's so severe that it's life-threatening. I mean, these are seasoned sailors. They know what a storm, they know what will kill them and what won't kill them, and they know this one will. And so that's what they say to him. This is going to kill us. And so there is Jesus with his head on a pillow in this deep, deep sleep, perfect calm. He doesn't have to make any preparations whatsoever to get ready for this storm. And at the appropriate moment, he's going to exercise his sovereign divine power. He's going to calm the storm. Now you get the picture. There's pandemonium everywhere all around him. There's chaos everywhere. You've got to know people are yelling and screaming, right? And it's not just their boat. Remember, there's other boats, right? They've got to be, I mean, they're like corks literally in a, you know, it's just amazing. And so in verse 24, they come down to Jesus and to wake him up. And they say to him, Master, Master, we're perishing, we're dying. We know what kind of storm we can survive and what kind we can't, and we're not going to survive this. We're going to die. And so when they say this to him, think about what they had seen him do. They knew that he had power over demons. He had cast them out before, right? They knew he had power over disease. They had seen that before. They knew that he could heal blind people. They knew that he deaf, crippled. They knew that he had power to take care of all those. But could he stop a storm? I mean, could he actually stop? Could he handle this immense, unequal power that they were looking at that they couldn't actually see, as Tom was talking about this morning? But they could feel the effects of it. Could he stop that? I mean, it's kind of interesting as I was thinking through this and studying through it. Here are these sailors, and who are they appealing to? Who is Jesus? A carpenter. The sailors are appealing to a carpenter. You got to figure he didn't even own a boat, right? I mean, didn't live anywhere close. And here they are appealing to a carpenter to save them. And so they come to Jesus because he's their only hope. I mean, they're desperate. Isn't that the way it usually is? I mean, we come to him when we're desperate, right? Here's what you need to know. That's okay. It's okay to come to him when you're desperate. I mean, when you think about it, the Lord himself created that desperation as part of driving us to him. And so if it weren't for the desperation, we probably wouldn't come to him at all, right? And so he creates the desperation so that we will cry out to him. He creates the storm. He creates the desperation so that we will plead with him to deliver us. And that's exactly what he does. And what he's going to do is he's going to bring an end to this storm here. And he says, look, you've got to be at the end of your resources. And once you're at the end of your resources, then I'll come in and I'll take care of it and I'll deliver you. And that's exactly what he does. And so at the end of verse 24, Jesus rebukes the wind and the waves at the end of verse 24. And notice how he says that at the end of verse 24, it says, and he got up and he rebuked it. And Luke doesn't tell us what he actually said, but Mark does. Mark tells us he just said, peace, be still. Just said the words, peace, be still. And that's what happened. And immediately the wind and immediately the waves recognized the voice of their Creator and they stopped. Now think about that. It's one thing for the wind to stop immediately. Waves? I mean, if you've ever been out on the ocean, it's just a constant thing, right? It's just, even if he stopped it, it would take a while for it to stop because of the and it says there was immediately perfect calm. When you think about it, the same way disease had responded, it was immediately. That's the way it was here. The same way demons had responded to him, same way here. The same way death had responded. I mean, the wind, the waves, they all stop immediately just like all those others. And so he says to his disciples, Matthew tells us that he says to his disciples, why are you afraid, O men of little faith? Now, if you think about that, if you're there, if he says to you, why are you afraid, what would you say? Duh. Duh. That's right. I mean, that's what you'd say. Look, have you noticed? I mean, I know you were asleep, but you can see now, right? And so that's what, I mean, at this point in time, Luke tells us that in verse 25, he says, "Where is your faith?" His first comments to them, he wakes up from his deep sleep. They've been fearful, running around everywhere. "We're going to die, we're going to die. Where's your faith?" You understand, he allowed the storm. He allowed the storm. He's literally in the storm. He creates this storm in order to demonstrate to them just who he is, that they can trust him even in the storm, and he increases their faith by doing that. At this point in time, they've got to be kind of hanging their heads. I mean, they've got to be a little bit embarrassed. I mean, it's kind of shameful when you really stop to think about it. Well, you know, we did see him raise somebody from the dead. I mean, we did see him heal. You know, we should have known that he could have taken care of this. And so he says to him, where's your faith? But I want you to notice something about the miracles. When you think about all the other miracles that he's done up until this point in time, who did they involve? Other people, right? The miracles were always, oh, he healed that blind guy. Oh, that blind guy. Oh, that is awesome. I mean, he healed that blind guy. That's amazing. Oh, he made that guy over there, his withered hands. Man, that's amazing when you really stop to think about it. I mean, that he could do that is really amazing. But it wasn't me, right? It wasn't my hand. It wasn't me that he gave sight back to. They're about to die. It's them now. The miracle affects them. That'll change your theology a whole lot when suddenly it's you. You know, it's one thing to say, "Oh, I understand the sovereign power of God, you know, and I see it in your life." But when it's your life that you see the sovereign power of God in, then you begin to understand it totally differently. And that's what you see here. In fact, you've got to remember this. I mean, this is tough for us to remember. He not only stops the storm, he does what? He started the storm. That's so hard for us. He not only can stop the storm, but he also starts the storm. Sometimes he starts the storm in our life to discipline us, right? To chasten us. And that's what Scripture says. He starts storms in our life because of our own disobedience. Other times, he starts storms just to increase our faith. I mean, you think about Jonah. You remember Jonah? Jonah's running off, and what storm comes in his life. Why? His disobedience, right? These disciples, Jesus says what? "Okay, hey, look, I'm tired. Let's go to the other side of the lake. Let's go, okay?" And what do? Okay, they're being obedient. They're doing what he said to do. He said, "Let's go to the other side of the lake." They're going to the other side of the lake. And he brings a storm in their life, even though they're doing what he told them to do. You see, being in a storm doesn't necessarily mean that you're being disobedient. You can be in a storm that's because of your disobedience, but you can also be in a storm that's just a strengthening storm that God's just using in your life to strengthen you and your faith. You see, in the case of the disciples, Jesus was part of the storm so that he could demonstrate to them who he really was. So that he could deliver them from the storm, and he would increase their faith in doing that, and they would trust in him even more. And so the worse the storm gets, the greater the level of trust. And they're at the point they're about to die. We know we're about to die. We're going under. We can see it. And he increases their level of trust. He controls the natural world. And certainly they would have seen that at this point in time. Now, as you move to the next story, beginning in verse 26 there, this topic says, Jesus controls the supernatural world. Jesus controls the supernatural world. In verse 26, they crossed over to the other side of the lake. They've gone over to Flower Mound. They're over at Flower Mound over there. They're on the other side of the lake. And when they get over to the other side of the lake, Jesus gets out of the boat. And when Jesus gets out of the boat, what does he do? He's walking over in Flower Mound area. He walks up to a graveyard, and what does he see? A naked man running at him, screaming and hollering. What would you do at that point in time? Back in the boat, right? Back, no doubt about it. Naked man running at you, screaming and hollering. You're back in the boat, right? Not what he does at all. He doesn't get back in the boat. He doesn't do that. He's got a lesson to teach, and so he's going to control this situation. He controls more than just nature. What he's going to say to him is, look, I control the unseen world. I control devils, angels, demons. I control all of that too. It's not just the natural world. I control the supernatural world. Now, a little background here. We really don't have any accounts in the Old Testament concerning demons. What I mean by that is there's no accounts whatsoever in the Old Testament of demon-possessed people. Now, it talks about some spirits and things like that, but there's no real accounts of demon-possessed people. There's no accounts in the Old Testament of an exorcism anywhere in the Old Testament. Now, think about that. And so now you come to the New Testament. You come to the time of Jesus. And you see these demons and all the way through the Gospels, demons and demons and demons and demons. But here's what else you notice. When you come to the epistles, when you come to Paul and Peter and John and Jude, no references to demon possession at all again. Old Testament, no references to demon possession, no references to exorcism. When you get to the epistles, after Christ is gone, apostles are gone, no references to demon possession. Now, when you get to Revelations, what happens? Demon possessions again. Demons, 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 everywhere. And so, you begin to study that and you begin to understand it's a period of time in here where He's dealing with them. And what you need to understand is He is the one dealing with them. Him, Jesus and His apostles and the 70 that He sent out. They're the ones dealing with them. Now remember, all these demons were once part of the angelic host. They know who Jesus is. They were created long, long time ago when everything else was created. They've been dwelling in the presence of God. They know who God the Father is. They know who Jesus is. They know who the Holy Spirit is. They were there with Him. They know exactly who He is. And so that's why ultimately they'll identify Him and say, you're Jesus, the Son of God. We know who You are. They were there with Him. They knew Him. They know who He is. They know that He is a sovereign God. They know that He is their judge and their executioner. They know all those things. And so here's the picture. He arrives on the other side of the lake. A man with a demon possession comes out to see him. He doesn't know Jesus. Jesus doesn't know him. But the demons know Jesus. And so when he sees him, we see that this man is clearly, he's a madman. I mean, literally, he is a certifiable maniac. He's absolutely, completely out of control. He has, his own personality is completely gone. He doesn't even speak. The demons speak for him. He doesn't think for himself. He doesn't act for himself. I mean, he literally is a madman in every sense of the word. Verse 27 tells us that he's living in the tombs. And what one writer said is it's clear that he's more at home with the dead than he is with the living. Now, get this picture. This lunatic, this madman, is living in the graveyard. And he's living there. The writers tell us that he would get up into the tombs and he would hide. And as I said before, he's naked. And he's hiding up in the tombs. And when people would come down the road, he would come screaming out of the tombs at them. That'll get your attention, right? I mean, that'll terrify you. I mean, the people were terrified of him. I mean, he's threatening their lives. And so everyone's terrified of this guy. Now, I need to mention here, and just for the sake of mentioning it so we can say we said it, no Christians, no examples anywhere of Christians ever being indwelt by demons. Can't happen. Can't have both God and Satan living in the same place. Christians are never indwelt by demons. There's no such thing in the Bible whatsoever. So when you hear these friends talk about this person is demon-possessed, all that, Christians cannot be demon-possessed. And if you want to talk about that sometime, you want evidence of that, I'll show you in Scripture where it talks about that. When this man sees Jesus, he doesn't know who Jesus is, but the demons know who he is, and so he goes running up to Jesus. Now understand, he's just doing what the demons are telling him to do. And when they get to Jesus, what do? They immediately fall down at his feet, is what the text tells us they do. And when they fall down at his feet, immediately as they're there, they're screaming out at Jesus, and they're pleading with him. And what is it that they're pleading with him? Well, if you look at verse 31, it says, please, 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 don't send us to the abyss. Don't send us to the bottomless pit. In verse 31. And so what the demons say is, look, we don't want to go there before our time, and it's not time yet, Jesus. You know it's not time yet, Jesus. You know that when you come again in the second coming, well, you know then you're going to send us into that abyss. You've prepared this lake of fire for us, and it's that time. Hey, Jesus, it's not time yet now. You can't send us there yet. Don't you send us down there. You've got to do something else with us. Don't send us to the abyss yet. We want freedom. Don't send us there. And so when Jesus speaks to him in verse 30, he says, "What's your name?" Now, we know that Jesus knew what their name was. So what is he doing? Why is he asking them that? It's for whose benefit? It's for our benefit, right? It is for our benefit so that we know. And notice what their response is. Their response is, "We're legion." Well, what kind of a name is legion? And not only does it say that, it says, for many demons had entered him, is what it said. Now, if you go to some of the other Gospels, we learn, legion is not a name. Legion is who they are, is how many they are. A legion describes a group of Roman soldiers, a group as many as 6,000. Get that picture. 6,000. As many as 6,000. We learn from Mark's Gospel that the pigs that he's going to send them into, there are 2,000 pigs. And all of those pigs get a demon. Whoa. It's at least 2,000 demons in one guy. And so that's what we've got there. It's all these demons in this one man, we are legion. And so we learn who he is, and what does Jesus say to him? Be gone. Literally, he just says, come out of them, and they're out. And with his spoken word, he overpowers them just by speaking the word. Verse 32 says, there was a herd of many swine feeding there on the mountain. And so they see these. Jesus says, I want you to come out. And the demons go, wait. Don't send us into that abyss. Do this. Hey, see those pigs? See those pigs over there? Put us in those pigs. Put us in those pigs over there. We had rather do that than for you to send us into the abyss, into the deep. Now, many have tried to make this a big deal here about the Jews were raising pigs, and the Jews were raising pigs, and about how they had gotten so far away from God but the text doesn't tell us that at all. The text doesn't say these were Jews raising pigs here. What the text tells us is that there were pigs there, and we can assume that it was just Gentiles raising pigs. Not just a few pigs, 2,000 pigs. And if you know anything about pigs and how many pigs piglets a pig can have, I mean, they can have lots. And so you can go from 200 pigs to 2,000 pigs very, 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 very quickly. Those of you who have been around pigs before would know that. So the demons beg him to permit them to go into these pigs. Really kind of bizarre when you really think about that. I mean, why would they say that? I was reading through some commentaries, and one of them said this is where deviled ham came from. Immediately my thought was, if this is where deviled ham came from, was where did deviled egg come from then? Anyway, Jesus says at the end of verse 32, he gives them permission to do that. Now, grasp that. He gives them permission to do that. Okay, I mean, that's really interesting. They couldn't do anything. These demons couldn't do anything that he didn't command them or let them do, that he didn't allow them to do. And so he gives them permission, and so it's totally under his control, and he gives them permission. Now, why would he do that? Why wouldn't he just send them to the abyss? Why wouldn't he just demonstrate his power and say, out of him, into the abyss? Well, understand, if he sends them into the pigs, and the pigs do what they do, what does everyone see? They see the demons. They know it. If they go into the abyss, they go, well, maybe they really left him, maybe they didn't, we really don't know. But if he sends them into the pigs, it's vivid proof to the people that these demons have left the guy. I mean, it's going to be proof of his divine power. It's going to show them the deadly intention of these demons is to kill, because that's exactly what they do. You see, as you look at that in verse 33, he kind of tells us that the demons came out of the man, went into the pigs, and off they go, run off a cliff, and all drown in the sea. I mean, the immediate reaction was, why would they do that? Why would they run off a hill, jump off a cliff, dive into the sea? But what is the point? The point here is 2,000 pigs killing themselves, jumping off a cliff and killing themselves. What a tremendous, dramatic illustration that this man had been delivered. And what had been in him went into the pigs. I mean, here was a man who was acting crazy, who was a madman, who was doing things that were just made no sense whatsoever, and immediately as soon as the demons leave him and go into the pigs do what? The same thing. And so that's what you see here. They became literally maniac pigs, madman pigs. That's what the people concluded as you read through it and read through the rest of the text, verse 34. That they knew about the man. They knew about the 2,000 pigs. I mean, if you live in the area and there are 2,000 pigs around, you kind of know. There's a lot of pigs around here, you know. And so they knew about them. They know about the character of that man. They know how he's crazy, he's scaring everybody to death. And all of a sudden, this thing takes place, and it's amazing to everybody. And so what's the result? Well, verse 35. The whole city came out. Everybody came out to see what happened here. Their interest was specifically in Jesus. Now, it's so important that you grasp that. Their interest is in Jesus. And what I mean by that, they know these herdsmen. They know the herdsmen have told them, here's what happened, here's what he did. They're not going out to see if it happened. They know it happened. They're not going out to see where the pigs are. They know where the pigs are. They're going out to see who is this man that told the demons to come out of this man into these pigs. Who is that guy? And so that's what they're doing. They want to find out who Jesus is and they want to meet him. Now, the reason why that's so important, as I was reading through this and studying through this, so many of the commentaries, so many of the pastors who have preached through this have talked about how the people were so upset about the loss of life of the pigs. The problem is it doesn't tell us that anywhere. It doesn't say that at all. You know, what the commentators will say, you know, the people were upset because it just wasn't right for him to kill all these pigs. It wasn't right for the people to be in so much care, so much more for the pigs than they did for the man. To kill somebody else's pigs was wrong. You know, all these kind of things like that. I mean, how dare Jesus do this? And somehow the commentaries have a way of just being more concerned about the pigs than they are about Jesus. You see, Matthew, Mark, Luke, none of them ever mention the owner of the pigs at all. They're never even mentioned. It never makes an issue out of it. Never makes any indication they're upset about the loss of these 2,000 pigs. But there are whole sermons that have been preached about preferring pigs over people. There are sermons that have been preached about being materialistic instead of spiritual. There are sermons been preached about all kinds of other things that you read into this. But there's nothing in the account whatsoever that they were more focused on the pig, more focused on the man. Nothing whatsoever that they were focused on Jesus. It's Jesus that they came out to see because they wanted to know who is it that could do this, that had the power to do something like this. And what did they see? When they come out, what did they see? Well, when you read the text, you know what they see? They came out to see Jesus, and they're sitting beside him as who? The naked guy's been living in the tombs, right? But instead of that, they've got this man who was completely out of his mind, sitting there with his mind. A man who had been living naked, sitting there fully clothed, sitting there with Jesus. A man who had been screaming and hollering every time they saw him, and he's sitting there completely calm. Instead of threatening, he's peaceful. Instead of tormented, instead of being insane, he's completely sane. I mean, this is shocking to them, and that's what they see when they come to see Jesus. And so first we see that Jesus has got control over the natural world. Second, he's got control over the supernatural world. And then lastly, he's got control over death. And that begins in verse 40. And I'm really going to skip over this one. I just don't have time. Here's what happens. 12-year-old girl's very, very, very sick. Her dad, who is an official, comes running up to Jesus, says, "Help me, help me, help me. My daughter's dying. Help me, help me, help me. She's sick. She's dying. Come save her, come save her, come save her." Jesus goes to save her, and as he's going to save her, this woman grabs his gown, who's been sick for years and years and years and years, and touches and he heals her. Keeps on going, and along the way, one of the servants comes to him and say, "Hey, look, don't bother. She died. Go on back. Don't bother Jesus at all. Go on back. She died." And Jesus says, "No, let's go on." And Jesus goes there, raises the girl from the dead, says, "Give her something to eat," and that's what they do. Clear indication is that Jesus controls death. Now, For those of you who have been paying attention, there's something that you should have noticed. I skipped over something in each little story. Go back to verse 25. At the end of verse 25, more specifically. When Jesus is in the boat, he stilled the sea. He says to them, "Where's your faith?" Notice what it says. They were fearful. And they were amazed, saying to one another, "Who is this that he commands even the wind, the water, and he obeys them?" That word that they were fearful. They were amazed. The word fearful there, it's the ideal of they were panicked. About what? What is it that they're panicked about? What is it that they, I mean, as I was reading through this and studying it, one pastor said this: what's worse than having a storm outside of your boat is having the creator of the universe inside your boat. Whoa. That's what was frightening to them. That's what was so fearful to them. That's why they panicked. Because now they know that God's there. God was outside the boat. He's out there in the storm. And now all of a sudden, God's in the boat with us. And God sees me for who I am. I mean, that's terrifying, right? And what happens is, if you remember back to Peter in chapter 5, verse 8, remember they've been fishing all night, and as they've been fishing all night, they caught nothing. Remember that? And Jesus comes up, and Jesus says, "Hey, look, just take your nets, put them over here, you know, catch a bunch." And Peter goes, "Hey, we're the fishermen. We know what we're doing. Okay, we'll do it." And he does it. And remember what he says? "Oh, my goodness. Depart from me. Depart from me, Lord, for I am what? I'm a sinful man." He realized who Jesus was. What was more fearful, having him outside the boat or having him inside the boat? You see how frightening it is when you realize that the creator of the world, the holy creator, is there in the boat with you. And the text here says literally they went into fear, they went into terror. The trauma of being in the presence of God sets in. And that's what's going to happen in every one of these. It happens here. Look in verse 37. It says all the people around them, they begin to leave. And what does it say? For they were gripped with what? Great fear. When you go to verse 47, the woman who's been healed, what does it say? She's gripped with, she's trembling and she falls down at his feet. When you come to the dead girl in verse 56, her parents, and the ideal there, it's the ideal of fear. It's frightening to be in the presence of God. And so there's this holy terror that grips them all the way through this. So when Jesus delivers you from a storm, it has a twofold effect. On the one hand, you see the power of God, and that increases your faith so greatly. And you think about the storms that you've gone through in your life. I mean, sicknesses, loved ones dying, God providing His provision, and you go through that storm, and He just increases your faith. But on the other hand, as you go through that storm, and you know that God sees your weaknesses, and that God sees your sin, which increases your remorse. It increases your understanding of who He is. That's the terror that's verbalized there in verse 25. And what they say to each other, who can do this? I mean, who can command the wind and the waves to stop? I mean, it's a rhetorical question. They knew the answer, right? Luke doesn't give us an answer here because no answer is needed. Who is it that can control the wind? Who can control the natural world? Well, who is it that can control demons and Satan? Who is it that can control death? You understand what the text is telling us. And I've heard all these sermons on the text over and over and over again. But what is the text really telling us? What's the common denominator through all three of these stories besides Jesus? Jesus is there, but what is the one other common denominator? The disciples. The disciples are there through all three of these scenes, and they see it over and over and over again. What's it saying to these disciples and through them to us? This is God. Oh my goodness. This is God. And so they see that. Jesus controls the natural world. Jesus controls the supernatural world. Jesus controls death. Jesus has to be God. You understand? If it never was anywhere else in Scripture, it's here, right? I mean, certainly you can go to John and you can, but it's here. Jesus is God. They had no doubt about that. There's no argument about, oh, well, you know, I'm not really sure. Maybe he needs to do something else. No, they got it. He's God. He's the one that rescued us. He's the one that decides life and death. He's the one that calms the storm. That's who he is. Jesus is God. Now, here's what happens to us. We read through this, and it seems so obvious to us. Anyone could read that. Anyone can see that, right? Anyone can go through there and go, man, that's obvious. Jesus, he's God. But here's what we start thinking. If Jesus would just do this again, then people would believe. If Jesus would just calm the sea again, if he would just raise somebody from the dead, if he would just take demons, send them into 2,000 pigs, well, you understand who would, OSHA and everybody else would be after him if he killed 2,000 pigs. But anyway, not PETA, that's what I'm thinking of, not OSHA, PETA. They would all be after him. But anyway, here's what happens. It's the nature of sin to blind. It's the nature of sin to hate the truth. It's the nature of sin to reject the truth. Even to object proof when they see proof. It's the nature of sin to reject righteousness. I mean, here is, you can't refute this. I mean, this evidence is just so profound that Jesus is God. Here you have a miracle that just proves all of it. And do the people say thank you? Do the people say, hey, you rescued that guy with demons. I mean, I don't have demons, but if you can rescue him, that certainly means you can deliver me. But you don't see that. Look what you see in verse 36. Those who had seen it reported it, how the man had been made well. I mean, that's an interesting verse, isn't it? They saw it. They knew it. They knew what had happened. They knew that he had been made well. You would think sinners that have seen that would be convinced that he's got the power through this miracle to do anything then. But you don't understand the power. Well, see, what happens to us is we start thinking, man, if we could just get somebody saved, man, if we could get Troy Aikman, man, if he would ever come out for God, just think about what God could do with him. And that's what we start. Or if we did this, or we changed that, or we started. But that's not what happens, is it? It blinds them. People aren't convinced. You see, the power of damning sin just, it obliterates reality is what it does. The idea that sinners are going to be converted by some type of a miracle just isn't true. I mean, pretty big miracle right here. And so what did they do? Verse 37. All the people, everybody, and it seems to say, without exception, everybody did what? Get out of here. We don't want your kind around here. We don't want you around here. And that's what they say. I mean, you guys just go away. Why? Why did they want him to go away? What were they terrified of? They knew they were in the presence of God. They knew they were seeing this great power, and they knew that it was a holy power, and because it was holy and he was cleansing, I don't want that around me. All this, they're loving evil more than they're loving him. There's not a word of thanks whatsoever for their deliverance, for the deliverance of this man. They see Jesus as a greater danger to them than that man. That man that would come running down from the graveyard naked, screaming, terrifying them, and Jesus is a greater danger to them than he was. They'd rather have that maniac than they had the Son of God. They'd rather be terrified by Satan than be terrified by God. You see, they were not asking Jesus to go away because he had messed up their economy by killing a bunch of pigs. That isn't even mentioned. They weren't asking him to go away because they were more concerned about pigs than they were about people. the whole town, the whole region came out and they wanted him to go away because they were terrified of his holiness. The world is more comfortable with pigs and with maniacs than they are with Jesus. We forget that. Over and over and over and over again, we just forget that. They'd rather have the presence of Satan than they had the presence of Christ in their life. I want you to see how this ends in verse 37. Verse 37 says he gets into a boat and he returns. He never came back again. Whoa! Never! He's there one time. He goes across the Sea of Galilee, gets off the boat, goes up, does this one miracle. They say, get out of here, and he leaves, and he never comes back again. Whoa! I mean, what a damning rejection for Jesus to never come back again. You remember Luke? Remember we said Luke is the CSI guy when we first started the series. Remember his whole reason for the book of Luke is to prove to skeptics that Jesus is real. Jesus is real. And what he's saying here is Jesus is God. And he's not just some great teacher. He's not just someone who's going to make your life better. He's not just someone who's going to fix your marriage, give you great kids, make you the person you think you should be. He's God. And that's what Luke is saying. I'm proving it to you is what Luke is saying. You see, the presence of Jesus in our life should cause us to worship Him. This is God. I mean, shouldn't we worship? I mean, you think of all the things that we worship around us instead of Him. And so the question for us is obvious, is what about us? What about you? What would you have done if you'd have been there? What would you have done if you'd have been there that day? Would you have cherished your sin, your sinful life, more than Jesus and said, go away. I love what I'm doing more than I love you. I don't want you around. Go away. Or would you have pleaded with Jesus? They said, Jesus, I saw what you did with that guy. Deliver me like that. Do that with me. I mean, that's really the question for us today. What would you do with Jesus today? Do you treat Him as God, or do you just treat Him as another of the many, many gods that you have in your life? And you've just set Him on the shelf with all the other gods of your life. And that's really the question for us today. That's the question for us in this coming week. How do we treat Jesus? Do we treat Him as God, or do we just treat Him as any god or as another god? Let me close this in prayer, and then we'll take any questions or comments that you have. Our gracious Father, we have to say thank You first. Father, thank You for sending Your Son. Father, for You to condescend and come here to such a sinful, sinful people, to a people that would see miracles like this and go, get out of here. We want nothing to do with You. Father, we are such a sinful, sinful people. Father, if not for Your grace and Your grace alone, every single one of us in this room would say, go away. But Father, because of Your grace, and simply Your grace alone, not because of anything that we've done, not because of who we are, Father, we cried out to You simply because of Your grace. Father, help us to worship You as our God. Help us to see Your Son as God. And Father, when we come and face a lost and dying world who doesn't know You, who truly doesn't see You for who You are, Father, help us to be bold. Help us to cherish, Father, what You've done in our lives and to demonstrate ourselves faithful. And we pray this in Your Son's name. Amen.